We don't have a quorum, so we'll begin anyway, and then officially call us in when we do have a quorum. Today, we actually were just going to take advantage of some time to go over, kind of do an overview of the state grant formula. Last year, there was questions and there was discussion about it, and we didn't have the opportunity to explain to members exactly how the formula is carried out. We talk about the appropriation and how to divide and split up maybe the dollars between systems, but we never talked about how those dollars actually get funneled down to the students. So we're going to take some time today to discuss that. Unfortunately, the members that probably could use the lesson the most aren't here right now, but hopefully they'll come in soon so they can hear and find out more about this. And then we also have, it is, as you see, many students here today lobbying us today, and we'll take some time after we are done with the grant program overview to let the students testify, not specifically related to the grant if they don't want to, but just overall on issues of concern to them. So this room might be filling up at times. We apologize. We didn't realize the student organization was going to be here until Monday, and there was no room available to switch, so we're just going to have to put up with the tight quarters. But with that, why don't we get going on the grant formula, the overview of the state grant program. With Phil Lewenstein from HESO to start us on that process. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman Stang and members of the committee. Phil Lewenstein from the Higher Education Services Office. Thank you for the opportunity to provide information about the state policy for determining state grants, which we call the Design for Shared Responsibility. We'll be providing an overview of the policy with particular attention to students and families from different income levels and different post-secondary choices, and as we move into it, we'll be working through how the formula works in serving those students. First, we want to thank the committee for its work last session and previous years to increase the state's investment in need-based financial aid so that Minnesota students and families from all economic backgrounds have the opportunity to invest in and obtain a post-secondary education that best meets their needs.
Mr. Lewenstein, view this way. We do have a quorum, so officially call the meeting order. Thank you.
For this biennium, you provided a biennial increase of $40 million for the state grant program and restored funding for work study and state child care grant program. And these actions are helping students trying to keep pace with the rapidly rising prices of a college education in Minnesota. In your packet, we have some background information on those actions, which you can look at your leisure. This is a milestone year in financial aid in Minnesota. Through your work and the hard work of your predecessors in the legislative and executive branches, Minnesota has been and continues to be one of the leading states in providing financial access to post-secondary education for its residents. And that's an accomplishment for which we all can be proud. This year is the 35th anniversary of the Minnesota State Grant Program. The program was authorized by the 1969 legislature, and 364 students received $200,000 in 1970. In fiscal year 2003, last year's academic year, state grants totaling $133.6 million, the largest amount in program history, were awarded to more than 72,000 students. Also, this is the 20th anniversary of the financial aid policy, the Design for Shared Responsibility, which, as you'll hear, represents a partnership of students, families, and taxpayers in financing the price of post-secondary education, and this has been and continues to be a national model. That policy was adopted by the 1983 legislature, and its implementation began in fiscal year 1984. Quickly turning to the present, you know, especially if you have college-age children, or if you have had college-age children, or if you will soon have college-age children, that this is the time of year when you apply for financial aid for next fall. Most colleges have financial aid deadlines for their institutions that are around the corner. And you need to fill out the FAFSA, which is the free application for federal student aid, and in some cases, the college scholarship service profile, and perhaps even some institutional-specific applications. Colleges then formulate a financial aid package for the student that may include a mix of grants, loans, and work from different sources, the federal government, state government, institutions, and private sources. and that is designed to help the student pay the price that the student's charged at his or her institution. Forming the foundation of the financial aid package is need-based grant aid from the state and federal governments, and particularly the federal Pell Grant and Minnesota State Grant. And today, Jerry Setter and Cheryl Mapplethorpe of the services office staff are going to explain how the state grant award is determined. And we have some other staff people here also who work on financial aid. Jenny Dodds, who works with the financial aid programs, and also Tim Garrity, and they can help answer any questions. And we've provided for you a packet of a lot of information in the green folder, which you're free to look at any time. So thank you, and I'm going to turn it over to Jerry Setter.
Thank you, Mr. Lindsay. Welcome, Mr. Setter.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Gerald Setter. I'm a staff at the Higher Education Services Office. And I'm wondering if you're using a paper that looks like this. It's basically, I'm going to be using it as in lieu of overheads. There's some notations or script in there that will help if somebody wants to read it at a later point. I would like to go through the design for shared responsibility as is outlined in statute, and then Cheryl will deal with some specific examples. As Phil pointed out, there are three ways that you can pay for college. You can use current income, you can use past income, often called savings, or you can use future income. But all of those are your income, your resources, and the state policy does not make a differentiation of how you're going to fund, how the individuals should fund their portion. They could use any one of those three, and they are treated virtually the same within the state grant program. Again, the policy is embodied in statute, requires students to make a significant commitment. Well, you can call it a copay, you can call it their share, you can call it a down payment on this investment. Families are asked to make a commitment or a assigned a responsibility based on their ability to pay, and we'll talk a little bit about how that ability to pay formula works and how it translates into by income for various students. And then the taxpayers, federal and state, are assumed to pick up the remainder in this particular policy. The state controls a number of the levers here so that while this is a formula-driven award for each student and the money follows the student, as you probably remember from last time, you had to set a number of parameters to get spending to at a level which you obviously felt comfortable with or the process generated. If you look at page 2, there's a table that outlines from average tuition and fees by some institutional groupings. The first column, which says posted tuition and fees, is based on an average for each institution and then weighted by the number of applicants that we have in the state grant file. We have about 130,000. So that institutions in that grouping that have more applicants get a heavier weight than those that don't. The second column does the same thing, except that the tuition maximums are applied to each student. And as you see that for the two private groupings, the recognized price is less than the posted price. Now, the recognized price is a little less than the actual tuition fee maximums, which are stated above, of $89.83 for four-year institutions and $69.13 for two-year institutions. And that's because not all institutions in those two groupings charge a tuition fees equal to the tuition fee maximum. And this average reflects that. Basically, it is the lower of actual, or actually average, and the tuition fee maximum for each student. But, of course, the third column is just the difference between those two numbers. On page three, there is a table that outlines the price that is used in calculating the award or the cost of attendance as it's outlined in the statute. That takes that recognized tuition fees, which is the middle column on page two, adds an allowance for living and miscellaneous expenses, which is currently set at $5,205. That was a decision made within the appropriation process to set the number at that level. That's in, technically in law, in that statute. This is intended to provide support, recognize the cost of living, well, living expenses, room board, books, and other expenses associated with attending. I think most people would say this is on the low side of frugal, but that's the number that's being used in the program. So we take then the third column, which is just the sum of the first two. We have five numbers which represent five different groups of students, if you will. Currently, before I go on, that number assumes that the student is registered for 15 credits per semester for two semesters, or three quarters, or the equivalent if they don't use either of those metrics. Now, if a student is registering for less than that full time, then that price that you see on page three is prorated based on 15 credits. So if they were taking 12 credits, I believe it's 80%, 12/15 is 80% of that number. Also, the awards are calculated each term, so if a student only shows up one term, they essentially get half that award that calculates from the full year award. So you take those numbers that you saw on page three and you multiply them by 46% each one, and you get a set of what is called assigned student responsibilities, which is depicted in the chart on page five. The important point is, the two important points. One is, as the price goes up, the amount that students are expected or assigned goes up, and they can cover that with their own income, past, current, and future, or if they can find somebody else to pay for it. This, for the perspective of the state grant program, it's indifferent of how that would be covered, but that is what students are, their assignment, if you will, their copay. The second is that it's flat across incomes, assuming that this is an investment students make and that the investment returns do not depend upon the income of the family. That is, quote unquote, an assumptions made. There has, from time to time, there are discussions of that, but in the end, I think most people come to the conclusion that there's not a strong relationship, if there is any relationship, between family income, between education and returns once that, in other words, somebody from lower incomes who completes this program will have the same income possibilities as someone whose parents make somewhat more. That assumption is buried in there. It is part of state statute. Just try to point that out. So having covered that part, we have the remainder, which is the difference between the recognized price that we saw on page three and 46% or 54% of it. And then we look at families, and we use an ability to pay measure that looks an awful lot like what is used for the what is popularly called this property tax circuit breaker. It's similar, not some of the rates are different, but it has the similar kinds of definitions. If you look at page 8, I'll try to outline some of the key components that are taken into account. For those of you who have filled out what was called the FAFSA, All of that data is used. No additional data other than what is required on that form is used in calculating this award. Over to the left, you see we start with some definition of total income for the almost all students and families. It's their adjusted gross income as defined for federal tax purposes that drives that income column. You notice there's some allowances for various taxes, and then there's a, what's called an income protection allowance that recognizes the size of family. So as family increases, the number at the bottom gets smaller. And the other point is if there are more than one family member attending, the bottom line is divided equally among all family members attending. So the slight difference from what you might say call the income tax model is over on the right side. There is some assessment done on what's called adjusted net worth. Not all assets are included, and if an asset is included, the liability associated with that asset is taken into account, so it's the net worth of that investment. Homes and the family farm are not included. It is basically some business. If you have business assets, they can be counted that aren't home or part of the family farm investments. And there are some discrepancies for types of investments. It's basically the attempt was to find those that could be converted into cash quite easily, like savings accounts and stocks and bonds. As we move into more complex financial instruments, some of these are included or not, and that's always a contention. And this is all taken based on what the federal, what's called the federal need analysis, is embodied in the Higher Education Act, so that we can use the same data, basically. On page 9, what we have done again is taken the dependent students we have in our database, looked at their income in these, I believe it was 23 categories, and took the median of the number that was calculated for each of those students using the formulas that are embodied in page 8. And as you can see, as you move up to 100,000, these families are assigned numbers of 20,000. We'll see in a minute that we never get to that level in the state grant program because we never have that much the leftover from, if you will, the 54% of the recognized price doesn't get quite to 10,000, so you can get a sense of where the typical family is cut off, and we'll look at that again as we move down. On page 10 and 11, there's essentially the same analysis for independent students who are single without any dependents of their own. Now, if you have a an independent student who has children, the formula works a lot like the one that's shown on page 9. But for this group, there is less protection of assets and income. And as you can see on the chart on the right, on page 11, the assessment is more rigorous for this group than it is for the parents of dependent students. At the top of page 11 shows how that the federal calculation has been adjusted. And that's just simply taking the number that comes on the bottom of page 10, taking either the 90% or the 72% to get the state value or the assigned family responsibility for this group. And those decisions have been made, and the appropriate legislative appropriation process over the last, I think it's getting close to 10 years when those decisions have been made. Anyhow. Go to page 12. The pictures on page 12 are exactly the ones that we looked at on page, I believe it was 7 and 9, except that the amount assigned to family is capped out at 54% of the recognized price. So there's two things that I think are worth noting here that helps for me at least understand how this works. One is on the lower incomes or the left hand side of this chart, does not make any difference what institution a student chooses, the family's expected or assignment turns out to be the same. In other words, this is based totally on their ability to pay. Obviously, when you move off to the right side, as you face higher prices, that family is expected to cover more dollars than they were. If the student choosing a higher priced option, their family is expected to, they're assigned more dollars than the families who are the students who choose lower price options. Did I get that fairly close?
Mr. Chairman. Representative Carlson.
On that point, could you explain where tuition discounting comes into the equation? And I've heard various percentages. One that I heard the other day, I don't recall the source, was that the average was something like 30% at a private institution. But with your comment that you just made, how does tuition discounting play into that?
Tuition Mr. Chairman.
Or scholarship, whatever the individual institution chooses to qualify.
First off, in a private institution, the recognized tuition is considerably less than the total. In fact, it's about half of what the average is. But
I recognize that. What I'm asking, though,
beyond that point, there is no consideration given to other discounts or scholarships that the students get. They can use that to cover their portion of it, if you were thinking in this
Representative Carlson?
We can pursue it maybe a little bit later, eh?
Mr. Chairman, that's essentially trying to follow what the state statute says, yes.
Representative Cox?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In that same line of thought, if I'm understanding it correctly, the highest recognizing price of attendance you have is $14,169.
Yes.
And if, let's say a private, going along with Representative Carlson, let's say a private school was $10,000 more than that, $24,000, you're not recognizing the $10,000. They just need to deal with that on their own.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cox, yes, that's true.
Okay, thank you.
And, Mr. Chairman, I would point out that if you're talking about just tuition and fees, you're really talking about 89, 83 is all that the state grant will recognize.
Thank you.
The other point on page 12 is, again, the independent students who are without children or are single are treated more rigorously or assessed at a higher rate, and you can see that by comparing the two charts. Otherwise, the treatment of the two groups are the same, it's just a higher rate here. And in this case, the student's income is taxed or assessed. The premise, as I try to understand the statute, is that an independent student has assumed the responsibilities that society or the state has assigned to parents of dependent students. And so they could be taxed both for the 46% as well as some on the income or other resources they bring. On page 14, we can go into this later if you would like, but this is essentially, if you were looking at the tax incidence study, we would take the numbers that are embodied in page 12 and divide them by income. You get what's called the assigned family efforts here, or the percentage of adjusted gross income. Now, all those other variables are taken into account. We're just using adjusted gross income to make it clear what is on the horizontal axis. And you see the percentage goes from 0 to about 11%. For dependent students and up to 20% for a group of independents to as ones that, again, are single with no dependents. So moving then to the taxpayer piece, we had a price. We subtracted the amount that students were assigned, and we subtracted the amount families were assigned, and you get the remainder, and that's what's called the assigned taxpayer responsibility. And that's shown on page 15. And again, as price goes up, the amount that gets falls to taxpayers increases as well. The federal Pell Grant, which does not depend upon tuition, is shown in for typical students. And the state grant is the difference between the appropriate line and then that shaded area that represents the Pell Grant. So if we took the top chart on page 15 and put it at the top of 16, you have a federal share and a state share. Again, that decreases rather rapidly with income. This is for one of the prices, but all the rest of them would just be the height of those bars. And that splits out, and at the bottom will show a federal share and then the state share. And then summing up the formal part of this presentation on page 17, the three parts go together to cover the price for all students. For this particular price level, which is the 12,590 as used in the charts, there is a state and or federal grant up to incomes of about $60,000-$65,000. Beyond that point, the student and the family is assigned the whole responsibility, and there is no taxpayer or state taxpayer money coming through the state grant to those families. Mr. Chairman, I'd stand for questions, or if you would wish to wait till after the Ms. Mapplethorpe presents examples, we could then come back for
some. I don't see any questions right now, but there may be some later. Thank you, Mr. Setter. Welcome, Ms. Mapplethorpe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Cheryl Mapplethorpe. I'm with the Higher Education Services Office. I just wanted to give you some specific examples to demonstrate the policy that Jerry just went over. And it will be in your green packet on the left-hand side, the first couple of handouts. We've given you a chart that shows three different students at four different colleges, and it walks you through line by line the different parts of the calculation that Jerry just went through, so that you can see the end result state grant that that particular student would get at that particular school. Sometimes different people like to see a lot of different income rankings, and so we've given you charts that show you different income categories at different kinds of schools. And we've got a dependent calculation and an independent calculation, and these match the chart that we've given you. If you'd like me to, I can walk you through line by line, but basically these are the headlines.
Do you have maybe looking at just like these three examples, mm-hmm. maybe if you could go through them and just kind of explain the differences a little bit
okay.
between them would be helpful.
Right. The first student we've given you is a student, is a dependent student, which means you're looking at the parents' income, and it's an income range of 45 to 50. You'll see that at the very top line. The different parts of the calculation is we've given you the tuition and fees at a particular college, and we've given you four institutions as examples. Next, we have given you what the recognized tuition and fee is, so that you'll notice, for instance, under St. John's, the tuition and fees that they're charging would be $20,000, but the recognized is $8,983. That's the maximum tuition that we take into account at the state grant. The next line down is the living and miscellaneous amount, which is $5,205, and as Jerry said, that's in law. You add all of those together and you have the recognized budget that we're using, or cost of attendance, price of attendance. The next line is the student share, which is set at 46%. That's subtracted. That gives you the family taxpayer share. In the next line, we have subtracted what the parental contribution is. Within the needs analysis, there's the parental contribution, and then they do an analysis of what the student can contribute. So, for instance, Pell Grant takes into account the student and the parents together to decide what the Pell Grant is. Within state grant, we're only taking what the parents' situation is. So that's subtracted. Then in the next line, in this particular student, we're subtracting what the Pell Grant dollar amount would be. And then the result after that is the state grant. We followed the same pattern in the middle of your chart. You have the a family, a dependent student that has an income range of 15 to 20. And you're following the same pattern. The basic difference is that when you get to the family contribution, or family of 15,000 to 20,000, that contribution is zero. But the Pell Grant that they would get also has changed, which is 3,300 in this example. And then you get the end result of what the state grant would be. In the last example, we've given you an independent student. So we're looking at that independent student's calculation. The first several lines are the same. The budgets would be the same. Under the contribution for this student, which has an independent student with an income of $5,000, the contribution is $464, Pell Grant $3,400, and then it gives you the state grant per college. And if you were interested in some other income other than the ones that we've given you, you can find that income on these charts.
Ms. Mapplethorpe, just so I understand this clearly, and members do as well, with the dependents, the middle example on the bottom, they qualify for the Pell Grant, so the state grant is $4,362, plus they get the Pell Grant of $3,300. So it's a combination of both for assistance they get.
Okay. Yes, Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Thank you. Are there questions for Representative Carlson?
I'm not sure if it is of Ms. Mapplethorpe or Mr. Sutter, but wanted to pursue the question of the private two-year. You didn't happen to have them on this list, but they were referenced in the other handout that Mr. Sutter went over. And a question that I raised a year ago was the number of private two-years that we're converting to four-year institutions by adding a four-year program, even though it might be, if you'll recall, relatively small. I think I get information from your office about that. So my question is, what's happening in that sector a year later? Is that continuing to grow and expand? And for the benefit of the committee, then, of course, if they convert to a four-year, then they increase the level of aid that they would be receiving.
Mr. Sutter.
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, as a result of the discussion we had at the last session, now the tuition fee maximum is based on the program choice the student makes, so that if a say Brown College adds a four-year program, which they have, most of their students fall under the two-year tuition fee maximum. So we have not tried to sort out the counting of specific students, but most of the students that are in these programs, are in these schools that are adding four-year programs, are subject to the two-year tuition fee maximum.
Okay, so in essence, you're comfortable with that having been corrected then?
Mr. Chairman,
Mr.
Well, you have corrected it. Well, it was corrected in the last appropriation bill.
And I requested and was trying to recall what the outcome was on that. Mr. Chairman, I did have another general question, and I guess Mr. Setter might be the best one on this one. In the overall budget, are we running ahead or behind in terms of the amount of resources that you have kind of bottom line?
Mr. Setter.
Chairman, Representative Carlson, ahead and behind depends upon which side of the you're sitting on.
The appropriation large enough.
I'll answer the question. I was just going to change the question and try to answer it without using those words. The appropriation was $140 million for each of the 2 years. We expect that tuition, everybody's telling us they're going to increase tuition and fees next year. But we're not spending all of the money this year, so that the appropriation is going to have more than cover what appears to be spending commitments for this year and for the biennial.
Mr. Senator, sure. Along that line, if I could real quickly, when we went through the budget, did we not factor in a 15% increase essentially for both systems, both years? So didn't we budget for that last year at conference committee? Are you anticipating that we didn't factor in enough for those increases fulfill through the 2 years?
Mr. Chairman, there will be at the present spending levels, and the report is due, I believe, on Monday or Sunday, that updates, and we're at the final stages of reviewing those numbers. But there will be enough money in the biennium if the current spending patterns hold. My only point in noting that the appropriation was even for both years, if we have a surplus this year in the account, that doesn't necessarily translate into a surplus next year.
Mr. Chairman, and that my follow-up question was similar to yours, but going back to the choice of words you used, you said more than enough to cover. And you know that's been one of the issues that's been before this committee, and committee members and you have heard me comment before that when you have more than enough, that means that we didn't give, at least within our target numbers, as much as we might have to Minsky and the University of Minnesota for their base funding. Could you expand on what you mean by more than enough? It sounds like you're comfortable that you're going to finish the second year of the biennium in the black. But at least as your experience is this year, and as the chair just pointed out with the fact that 15% was built into the second year, are we going to have a situation again then where we're going to have large sums of money that will go back into the general fund? And well, we have missed an opportunity to have provided more aid to the university or Minsky, or another option would be to have increased the financial aid. I mean, there are different things that we could have done, but we work off a fixed number as a result of what's negotiated with the Senate and what the Ways and Means allows us to work with.
Mr. Setter.
Mr. Carlson, again, we're finalizing some final numbers to have the 15th, the 15th of February. Based on the December 1st deadline, or report, there was a surplus, and I am not exactly sure what it is. I would prefer to refer to that report so we have the number specifically to answer your question. But there would be a surplus slightly more than we had expected at the end of the session. There was a surplus built in the appropriation process.
Mr. Chairman, maybe a question, if I might, of you then. Would the intent, because that's been an important issue before this committee, the cancel backs. Well, we have an opportunity to hear from them after they've completed that report, so we at least know what the current standing is as we look at the next biennium. And then I think we would need to have a dialogue with ESOL about if that number is positive and significantly positive, would there be a chance for us to perhaps do some reallocating?
Representative Carlson, we, as soon as they have the report done, we will have ESOL back here to give us that information so that we can all be working out the same numbers. Hopefully we'll have hard numbers. I've heard varying degrees of what we could be expecting. Obviously, we'll wait to see what the governor proposes to do as well in his budget in dealing with it if there is a surplus. But I know we have to be cautious because those numbers are not always hard, and we ran into a problem 2 years ago when we took too much money out and then had to do the cutoff date. So I think we certainly will have that dialogue, but we'll probably approach it pretty cautiously as well. Do you have further questions, Representative Carlson?
No, I was just, okay. You answered that, Mr. Chairman, by saying that they will be back, and at least we'll have that dialogue, so thank you.
Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. You pretty well summed up what I was going to say. I just think let's move really cautious. We don't want to go back where we're going to kids in the middle of the year and telling them we don't have the money there. I just think let's move real careful. I hope we've been to the bottom and that we're careful that we don't take from there. Thank you.
Representative Cox.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As many of you know, I have two daughters in college now and am intimately familiar with the FAFSA forms and so forth. But in visiting with their friends, you know, I hear different levels of concern expressed on either how well the state program works or how well it may not work in their particular instance. Hear a little bit from parents on that too. One of the things, and I'm focusing on just looking at, since the living and miscellaneous expenses is basically the same, treated the same across the board, if you just look at tuition and fees, do you track to know what the average increase in tuition and fees for, you know, Minsky, the U, and the privates are from 0203 to 0304? And then is what the to see what the net increase after the awards of the grants that are out there. I mean, is that something that you track to know? In other words, when they get their increases in their tuition and fees, how are the grants holding up to cover any of those increases?
Mr. Sutter.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cox, informally we have done that a number of times. I do not have specific percentages in my head at this point on that question.
Mr. Chair, I would appreciate it if we could get a handle on that. I'm curious to know at what pace our state grant program is, you know, either holding its own or not holding its own in, compared to what the Minsky and the U and the privates are seeing increases on the tuition and fees side only, not the living and miscellaneous. Thank you.
Representative Dorn.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and on a connected subject, but one not on the paper, and visiting with students in my office earlier, the subject of work study came up, and visiting with one student, the comment was made that while he was authorized, he could receive $1,800. Mainly the message was $1,200 was all there was or what there was. How are we doing? Because for a lot of students, that's how they fill in the gaps of, you know, where the shares come in. How are we doing on the work study funds? Are they flowing the way we thought, or are we running short there, or what's happening? Can you share a little light on that piece?
Ms. Mapplethorpe?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Mr. Dorn. The amount of work study that we have available this year is the amount that, $12,400,000. As you know, last year that money was not there. It was put into the state grant. But it is the same amount that we have had in previous years. Students should have available to them both federal work study and state work study. Those funds are always very popular. Perhaps the difference that you were talking about between the $1,800 award and the $1,200 they were thinking they would have available. I'm not sure if that mm-hmm. meant that the school was telling them that they were going to run out of work study before they got to the end.
Okay.
But typically the school makes an award of money and then the student works those hours until they earn that amount.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure what the difference would be between the $1,800 and the $1,200.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I will pursue some of that, you know, further, too.
Yeah, I'd be glad to talk in more detail about a specific student if there's a problem.
Along the lines of Representative Cox's question, what he's getting to, last session in conference committee, we made some difficult decisions when we took some money from the systems and put it to financial aid. Has HESO gone through the process? Do you have information that kind of illustrates how much we were able to hold down the impact of the tuition increases? I mean, the 15% increases that took place pretty much across the state, the students that received financial aid, was the real tuition increase impact on them in the, 7, 8, 9%? I mean, do you have information regarding that is available or that you could make available to us so we can see what was the impact of the decision we made last session?
Mr. Chairman,
second.
First point is that the entire tuition increase was worked into the formula, obviously split between students. The students had to pick up 46% of that increase. If their parents were on the left-hand side of that chart, the state picked up the remainder. With the one caveat, because of the way the LME works, or living miscellaneous expense or allowance works, there's a little over $100 smaller award that if you just took it straight up would look as not keeping up even with the 54% on tuition. But we can definitely pull those numbers together.
Mm-hmm. Well, Representative Nielsen, sir, did you have a question? I thought I saw your hand. Okay. See no other questions. Thank you both for your testimony today.
Appreciate it.
Next, we'll give the students an opportunity to present to us their concerns. We had scheduled this hearing on the state grant overview if the students want to discuss that, but I know you have other issues on your agenda that you want to talk to, so these are separate issues. You don't have to keep it to this topic. You can get to any topic of concern that you may have. So whoever would like to come first. Welcome back to the committee.
Mr. Chair, Representatives, my name is Corey Long. I'm the Vice Chair of the Minnesota State University Student Association.
My name is Brad Crassway. I'm a student at Winona State University.
Well, real quick, what I gave you already, it should have been passed around, I believe it was just something for your information. It's a graph of like a layout of where our tuition is at compared to comparable universities in the region. We kept it very regional for this, and we think that this is the most telling indicator of how we're doing in the state compared to the rest of the country. That's really just for the committee's information. It has a lot to do with appropriations and that sort of thing, which I'll touch on in a moment. And then I'm going to shoot through a few things here, and then we'll get on to the state grant stuff. First of all, today, as many of you may know, because I'm sure most of you have been or will be getting visits from our students, is our annual lobby day. The State College Student Association of 2 years will be here over the next couple days. We try and make it a priority to get out and talk to people as much as possible, like face-to-face, because I know emails and like sending our staff down is great and it's helpful and informative for everyone involved, but we like everybody to see who they're actually dealing with and affecting with everything. The first thing that I really want to talk about is the actual fiscal allocation to MinSCU for which essentially sets our budget. As I've been a student at St. Cloud State for 5 years now, I think. Yeah, somewhere in there. I don't know. It's been a while. I've seen our allocation compared to our tuition shrink, And it's just really disconcerting. I mean, like, right now, with aggregate tuition increases, I'm paying, like, 49% more tuition now than I was when I started. And a lot of it is due to the fact that now this year, for the first time ever in the state, like, I think it's five of our institutions are now funded more by tuition than state allocation, which just shows the funding priorities and how our allocation has shrunk over the last few years. I mean, I can go on and on and can bring in an army of students to talk about how, like, you know, budget cuts have, like, you know, have affected them. And I understand that it's, I mean, we're in tough, like, financial times, but and this is a statewide issue, but tough financial times around the state means that there's more of a need and a demand for higher ed. People go back to school for job retraining and everything, and we don't have the money. The other thing that comes along with that is the amount of debt that students are incurring. Let's look for the figure here. I think it was last year students borrowed $500 million through student aid programs, which is, I mean, that's a huge amount of debt for the state. In my opinion, personally, and I don't know how much that means, but it's just it's not viable economic plan to have our citizens, as they enter our workforce, to be repaying huge loan debts. I mean, I don't think that it's sustainable over a long period of time. Along with that, and I know we'll touch on this later, comes the issue of the Pell pass-through and the state grant. As you all know, I'm sure Minnesota state grant is reduced based on the amount of Pell grant the student receives, essentially. So more Pell grant equals less state grant, which essentially takes state grant, which is supposed to be a need-based aid program, and puts it on middle to higher income students, because the other students are hitting, like, you know, state grant maximums and Pell grants. I understand that there's a bill right now from Representative Carlson. We just strongly urge you to consider a Pell pass-through proposal, because I think nothing will help our students more right now. Moving on, is financial aid. Just financial aid in general, we really do support an allocation of financial aid monies to the systems for their disbursement. I think the systems have a better idea of the needs of their students, being MNSCU, the U of M, and then presumably HESO for private institutions. I think we all have a better grasp on, like, MNSCU has a better grasp on what MNSCU students need than someone outside MNSCU, just by the very nature of these. And we do fully support shifting the allocations to the various systems to disperse their own financial aid. Past that, I just wanted to talk about bonding a little bit, as we are in a bonding session. And just want to go over quickly, like, MNSCU's proposal, just very briefly. I mean, MNSCU has asked the legislature for about $275 million in bonding projects. The first thing on it is $100 million for HEPR, which is essentially repair and replacement. We have millions and millions and millions of dollars, I can't give you a figure off the top of my head, in deferred maintenance and that sort of thing in our bonded buildings that we haven't had the money to take care of. We have roofs falling in, you know, like masonry cracks, giant foundation cracks, plus, like, the problem with aging HVAC systems, and all sorts of things all over the state. The biggest thing is the $100 million for HEPR to help repair these things. And I think that the best way to show an investment in the buildings and the infrastructure of our universities is to actually make sure that the buildings we have do not fall down. And that's what this does. That's basically, I can't stress the importance of that enough. And then we have new projects that we've requested $175 million for. A lot of the projects, I think, are very strategically pointed towards the needs of the state. A lot of them, we have, like, various science buildings, various technologically oriented buildings and infrastructure that we need to continue to produce a majority of the state's nurses and healthcare workers, as well as teachers that we produce a multitude of the state's teachers at our institutions, as well as teachers that are like viable in the workplace and in the increasing technology that we see in a K-12 classroom. And moving right along, I think that I know that some of the committee members and the Senate committees heard this before. I think that as students, we don't fully believe that the governor's bonding proposal even reflects the priorities of the governor in his budget. Priorities of the governor that he stated in his budget were chiefly among them was creating jobs. And I think that being light on bonding in a budget when you're trying to create jobs just is a non sequitur. I mean, bonding creates jobs because you have to build things and you have to hire people to build them. And with that, I think we'll move into some state grant stuff, and I'll turn it over to my colleague here to open up with some of that.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Members, I want to thank you, first of all, for allowing us to speak here in front of you all. Today, I'm sure a lot of MSUSA students, state university students, have been coming into your offices and talking about opposing any cuts to MNSCU and abide by the statute of 135A.01. Financial aid dollars based on need, other issues, especially bonding issues, such as I'm a student at Winona State. We want to renovate our science building. It's one of the oldest science buildings in the state. It's hard to get an up-to-date education with facilities like that. And thank you very much for listening to our concerns. But right now, I want to tell you my story a little bit. I'm from Virginia, Minnesota. I attended Mesabi Range Community Technical College for 2 years. During that time, I did not receive a state grant because my parental income and my income together was, I guess, too much. My parents together, their combined income was $55,000, and apparently that was too much for the state to give me a state grant. So then they helped me at that point. Then I got married 2.5 years later as I graduated with my AA from Mesabi, and I transferred down to Winona State University. Last year, I received a state grant, but this year, being a fifth-year senior, I do not. Being that I didn't get a state grant my first 2 years, I only had one for 1 year. I don't think that's four-year eligibility. I don't think that's five-year eligibility, but apparently they call it that. And my fifth year now, I have to pay more out of my pocket, and with combined income of myself and my wife of $12,000, we don't receive a state grant, and we just took out, Monday just started taking out another $5,500 loan. Another means, yes, I do have other loans besides just that loan. So I'm here asking you to please reinstate that fifth-year state grant eligibility, as well as summer school state grant eligibility for students, so they don't have to go to that fifth year or try not to go through that fifth year too much. But it's becoming all more of a reality. You know, with tuition going up, people working, having to work more, taking less credits, that fifth year is almost mandatory currently. Earlier, Phil Lewistein said that HESO has $45 million available extra in this year's state grant. I think that'd be a perfect money to put in the fifth year state grant and the summer state grant eligibility. I guess I'm posing a question now: is how far do the members of this committee or the members of the House or the Senate want our teachers and our nurses and our social workers to go in debt? Because that's what's happening currently. And when 52% of the dollars in the state grant program go to 20% of the students in the privates, of course I'm talking about, and the 48% of the dollars goes to 80% of the students, it sounds confusing to me as far as where the priority should be, as far as needy students such as myself in that program.
I just want to stress a couple of points on the state grant program. Currently, I mean, we're falling behind with our state grants to address previous comments. I think changes like the fifth year thing and the summer thing disproportionately affect university, like public university students. We're the people that have to work two jobs while we're going to school as it is. If we had the money to just straight up pay for school, we may consider going elsewhere. But at this point, we have what we have, and many of us work multiple jobs, 40, 50 hours a week to afford to go to school, and that means that it's going to take you more than 4 years to get done with school. I mean, the current graduation rate across the system is 4.8 years, I think, and if I'm wrong, I think Mike Lopez is in the back of the room and he'll yell at me. But I think we're at 4.8 years for average graduation rate, and that, I mean, the state grant program doesn't reflect the reality there. Just to touch on the split between public and private, again, we estimate by our numbers and by HESA's numbers that about 20% of the state grant recipients are private institution students, but it accounts for 52% of the fiscal allocation in the state grant. So figuring it out just with the numbers that HESA gave us all earlier, $133 million, 72,000 students, that makes 14,000 private college students that are getting about $4,900 as a mean state grant, and about 58,000 public university students that are getting about $1,100 per person as a mean in the state grant. That state average is around it's $1,800, $1,850 if you divide it out across the system. That means that private college students are coming out about $3,000 above the state average for state grants, and public university students about $750 below. So I think maybe we need to look at reevaluating our priorities and where we're moving our money. People that choose to attend, HESO has stated over and over, and we stated earlier, if a student chooses a higher priced option, those students are assigned many more dollars than other families to cover. And I don't think that we quite have the formula tweaked to the point where that's where it should be. Just one more thing that I want to point out is that since 1995, the number of students with families, or from families that make less than $10,000 a year, or independent students that make less than $10,000 a year, the number of students receiving state grants in general has decreased by almost 11,000. And in 94-95 was a giant spike in the Pell Grant federally, and I think that it has a lot to do with it. I mean, those Pell dollars are not passing through. And I know that was... the whole of that all there was kind of scattered, but I hope we've adequately represented our stances on a lot of these things, and we'd be more than happy to stand for questions.
Thank you. I think clarification, I don't think the number was 45 million that they're projecting as a surplus, not quite that large, but I think there are ways that we can look at if there are dollars available in surplus to go back and look at some of the changes that we made last session to the grant program to try to get it balanced last year. Representative Cox.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do appreciate your comments and concerns about looking at the costs of privates and state college system. I think one of the ways that would even those things out is if we wanted to start looking at $200-300 million allocations to the private colleges. You are forgetting that we have allocations to hold things down for the state college system and the university system, and that isn't available to them. So there's factors that come into play there. I am interested, though, two things. Your comments on the Pell pass-through. And if we look at the chart that we've had before us today, there's $3,300 or $3,400 amounts for the Pell grants on there. If what you're talking about on a pass-through, I just want to clarify it, that the Pell Grant would move up to the to offset the student share and then increase the state share by that same level?
Essentially, yeah. What we would be essentially doing is eliminating what now currently exists statutorily as a dollar for dollar reduction in state grant based on Pell increases. So essentially it would be the state grant money would shift to lower income peoples as well, because they wouldn't run through their state grant maximum, basically, Pell grants.
Representative Cox.
And Mr. Chair, this would be just an additional bit of information, but it came to my attention when listening to this testimony is maybe we could get current figures on what the average debt for graduates, not, I don't care when they graduate, whether it's 4, 4.8, 5 years, whatever, from the state schools and the private schools and the university system, however, I think we've seen some of that in the past, but up-to-date information on that.
Does HESO keep track of that data at all?
No.
Okay. Well, maybe we can see if the institutions can can track that. I'm sure even the student organizations probably have data on their own students. Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if you signed, but Mr. Vigiano had his hand up on that question. I don't know if
you okay.
I had a question separate from that, okay. But I haven't noticed his hand was up.
Mr. John Frank Vigiano, MSUSA. The latest data that the College Board put out, this is national data, they'll give you a good idea. It's pretty relevant, I think, to Minnesota, the mix of schools and students. It's almost even now between public and private students. About 17,400 for private students and about 17,100 for public students, public four-year students, and that would include both comprehensive and land-grant
universities. Thank you. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I just had a general question because of the reference to the extra funds, and it goes back to the question I asked earlier, and I know you said you'd have them in next week, but apparently somebody's floating some numbers around. ESOL was referenced. I mean, are there some tentative numbers that could be shared with the committee? I guess you were the one that was referenced as having some number.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, it's $40 million. That was, I had mentioned that the legislature for this biennium provided an increase of $40 million in this grant program. Not that that was the projection.
No, I understood that the chair indicated that, that was not the case, but he also implied that there may be some numbers that are tentatively around now about how we're doing, but the report is due next week, so you must have been doing some work. Is there something
Chair,
you could share?
Mr. Carlson, the appropriations law directed us to update projections every quarter, and the last one was December 1st, and we provided a range based on whether you're looking at the population of applicants from fiscal year 2002-2003, and also trying to look at our current experience this year. And that range is, it is several million dollars that we're looking at for fiscal year 04.
Mm-hmm.
Again, we're being very cautious when you look at 05 and don't show much of a surplus there. But we're looking again at those numbers, and again, we'll have more for you next week.
So, Mr. Chairman, I know tentative numbers that you shared with some and not others at this point, then.
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, there is a report that we're required to have provided to the legislature. It's on our website. And you
That's Mr. Chairman, the December report.
Yes, December.
Yeah, I'm talking about if you had anything more recent than that.
Mr. Chair, we have
been sharing with
any
people. Okay, that wasn't my question. I said, did you have any numbers that you've tentatively shared with some and not others?
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, we have not shared any numbers
with anyone.
With anyone with regard to the February 15th. Projection. We have an internal meeting scheduled tomorrow to go ahead.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, then we'll just have to obviously wait. Just to kind of the way the conversation was going, it sounded like there were some numbers that were being talked about somewhere. But
he'd be a good
we'll
attorney,
wait.
Representative Carlson.
Representative Carlson, I may have
erred. You should be a social studies teacher.
Be very good, Representative Carlson. Actually, the numbers I was referring to were the numbers from the last report. So
from December.
From December. So those are numbers I used. Representative Nelson. Oh, I'm sorry, you were done, Representative Carlson.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question probably is for Mr. Wilson also, and that has to do with the numbers on the average state grant. There was some confusion in the testimony about that. Do you happen to have those numbers?
Mr. Lowenstein.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson,
Mr. Chair,
okay.
Can I just say briefly on that? The numbers that I just kind of threw out there were just real quick, like division in my head from what I do know. $133 million, 72,000 students, 20% of them private college, 80% public. it's division, but I needed a calculator anyways.
Could you give those numbers again?
The other thing I wanted to clarify, you mentioned that last year we eliminated summer grants. We actually made a change to the calculation for the Pell pass-through on the summer grants, but summer grants still are available for students. So just so that's not out there. Any other questions? Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is one for the students. You made reference in your disappointment to the not having the fifth-year grant, and I'm just curious, does MSUSA have a position that you would rather see fifth-year grants and a reduction in the number of grants? Assuming that there's a limited pot of money, you'd rather see fewer grants and have them be for 5 years. Our efforts on the four-year grant was to encourage students to try and graduate in 4 years, and the thought being there would be more four-year grants available than there would be five-year grants. And do you have a position there?
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, Frank just came up here and said to me, yes, fewer grants for higher income people, and that's it's short, but it's really definitely to the point. Mm-hmm. I mean, we think that if you shift down the formula to the people that really need the money the most, like you can cover a fifth year and all the way through college for the people that need it without a significant increase in allocation to the program.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you. Were there any other students that had wanted to testify, or were you to the representatives of the association?
I think we were the appointed mouthpieces.
Very nice guy. All right. With that, no other questions? Meeting's adjourned.